You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of May 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Very sadly, I can confirm that one of the victims is a serving police officer, but in respecting their family's wishes, I will make no further comment at this stage.
As we learn more about the victims of Monday night suicide bombing in Manchester, police make arrests in two countries. My guests Kathleen Burke and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including a look at Donald Trump's world tour as it heads from the Middle East to Brussels via the Vatican, the possibility that Fox News may have rendered itself redundant, and Taiwan prepares to give Asia an overdue nudge on the issue of same-sex marriage. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Michael Goldfarb, the journalist, author, and broadcaster. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the UK, where the general election occurring a fortnight tomorrow has been shunted from the headlines and indeed into temporary abeyance by Monday night suicide bombing of an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester. The bomber has now been identified as 22-year-old Salman Ramadan Abedi, the British child of Libyan refugees. British police, who believe he was part of a network, have now made five arrests, and there are also reports of an arrest being made in Tripoli, apparently of the bomber's brother. The UK's terror threat level has been raised to critical, meaning that further attacks are expected. Michael, first of all, does anything we've learned about the bomber so far surprise us in the least?
In some ways, no. It fits a stereotype. One is that people are radicalized through family and close, and some of these families' extended connections. So the idea that he might have been connected back, apparently it's reported, we don't know for certain yet, that he traveled recently back to Libya. His brother, it's reported, has been arrested there. So in some ways, it isn't surprising. The surprise would be if, as has been reported, he's been in Syria and Libya recently, why on earth was he not being monitored all the time by the security services? And I think that further reporting and also when the security services are prepared to tell us a bit more, we'll figure out what that one is. But in other respects, some of this isn't surprising at all, just that he escaped detection.
He does, Kathleen, appear to conform to they do start to fit a pattern, a lot of the people who carry out attacks such as this, and he does appear to tick quite a lot of boxes. His employment prospects appeared to be none too bright. He was a known user of drugs, especially marijuana. We haven't yet had the usual revelations of a background of petty crime and violence towards women, but I have to say they wouldn't be terrifically surprising at this point. But does the fact that this often appears to be the profile, does it actually help us at all? You can't go around sort of monitoring and or locking up every male under the age of 25 who fits that description.
Well, I must say I have a teeny bit of sympathy here for the security services. It takes 18 men, apparently, to keep an eye on one person for 24 hours. And until we're prepared to give several billion pounds more to the security services, it's going to have to be slightly random and you do the best you can. I'm sure he feels this. He of course he fits a stereotype. He and another 750,000 young chaps who don't really see a future in front of themselves, got bored at university, dropped out, weren't quite sure what to do, found someone online who thought they were wonderful. And wonderful to carry forth a cause that was self-evidently wonderful. So it's not surprising, and I have every sympathy again that there might be a network. These go through, not gangs, but links, friend to friend to friend to friend, and not always, but one gathers enough time. But the idea of the poor police trying to track the extended friendships of every person they suspect.
Well, you're quite right to say that there are unfair burdens or unfair expectations placed on the security services. There have now been reports as well that people had made calls to various hotlines concerned about this particular individual. But
beforehand.
Beforehand. Mm. But again, when you talk about deploying 18 people and the expense attending that to every single person that the police ever take a call about, it does become prohibitive. Michael, what have you made of the official response? The government here has invoked what's called Operation Tempora, yeah. And that the most visible symbol of that, of which is uniformed armed soldiers guarding key sites. Now, to a lot of our listeners, especially in Europe, that will seem entirely unremarkable. But in Britain, outside the special case of Northern Ireland, at least, it's very, very unusual to see troops on the streets.
It's only happened, I think, two other times in this... Well, since the 7/7 attacks in 2005, once just after the failed attack, again targeting young women primarily, there was an attempt to set off a car bomb packed with nails and shrapnel in Haymarket outside a happy hour kind of bar. That didn't work, but the bombers... They put this alert on, and the bombers got as far as Glasgow, where there was a major incident. And one of them was killed, and the other was severely burned. And then there was the time when there were suddenly tanks at Heathrow. So it isn't all that usual. And I think that going back to actually to what Kathy was saying about you need 18 security officers to track each one of these high-risk individuals. So what the soldiers are doing is that they're doing the cop work down at Parliament and at Buckingham Palace, and I imagine they will be recalled to barracks as soon as possible once this investigation has achieved what it means to do.
It has been on the previous occasions that Operation Tempora has been invoked. It has usually only been a matter of a few days that the police have been on the streets. But Kathleen, is there a theatrical aspect to this? Is it intended to make people feel safer? And speaking for yourself, does it make you feel safer if you see armed soldiers wandering the streets of London?
I have no feelings about it in that sense. I mean, it seems to me the point about having a critical level is two things, isn't it? One, it tells you to be careful.
This is the level at which we have now been moved up to.
Where we are imminently expecting something to happen. So on the one hand, it means be careful. You know, when you go to the tube, be careful. On the other hand, it says, look, we have to have these soldiers out, but don't blame us. So we're not militarizing the streets as they do in France and so forth and Italy. So I think in one sense there were two. They needed it, and they had to have a critical. I don't recall, Michael, whether the 2005 and the 2006 they went up to a critical level.
They did, apparently. That was now whether they deployed troops during that 3-day manhunt for the bombers, the failed bomb in Haymarket. I don't remember. It was a decade ago. But I do remember them dragging the tanks out to Heathrow.
I remember that, yes.
And I think a lot of people at that point were skeptical because...
There was a certain amount of mockery.
Because, it was Tony Blair. You know, and he had lost... And it was actually a good measure of how little credibility he had left with the public when it came to a security issue. And, of course, nothing happened, thank goodness. So, you know, it's entirely a moot point whether there really was a security threat. But I'd like to think that the fact that the UK government does not call out the troops willy-nilly means that when they do, there's probably a very good chance that they know stuff that we don't. It happens in the shadows. But does it make anyone feel safer? No, because it's the nature of this kind of terrorism. And Manchester, it's interesting. I can remember 21 years ago when the IRA blew up the center of the town and created the occasion to have the Manchester Arena erected in the first place.
Indeed so.
And I remember, the quote is not precise, but the thought is accurate. You know, the IRA always said, we only have to be lucky once, you have to be lucky every day. And it's like that with these guys, I'm afraid.
Those are, I'm afraid, the odds. A final thought on this one from you, Michael. We have seen a certain amount of further evidence of the leakiness of the current American administration. Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary here, has gone so far as to say she is irritated, which is an unusual language for a British Home Secretary, by the fact that US officials were releasing information on the investigation before British police were.
Well, I hope that colleagues in Washington are actually getting towards to figure out whether it came through the White House or if it was actually somebody in the security services themselves.
Well, it was the police who released it, wasn't it? It wasn't the security services.
Well, I mean, no.
The U.S. officials ahead of what the British police were releasing.
And the thing is that, you know, that what was going on and the reason Amber Rudd is right to be angry, and you know, British security people are right to be angry. They had this window where no one was sure that they knew who had done it. And they had this window. They're tracking down all of these known connections. And then suddenly, there it is, being made public. And also, I think Reuters was very naughty here in London. I mean, it was going to come out, but they didn't have to join in. They could have, you know, let it come out somewhere else. At moments like that, it's a couple of hours, just the extra hours where his associates aren't sure that the cops know who they are. And, you know, The leaky administration, it was just a dumb move.
Well, that's two intelligence services who have been hit now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Who's next?
Well, let's move along now on a not unrelated note, because elsewhere in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump is on his first trip abroad since his inauguration, and having, in fairness, confounded expectations by making it out of the Middle East without summoning Armageddon, he has today been in Rome and the Vatican, meeting with Pope Francis and Italian President Sergio Mattarella, and he will later fly to Brussels, where the leaders of EU and NATO countries are bracing themselves. Kathleen, Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, which in fairness was never likely to be terrifically pro-Trump, but nonetheless ran a spirited op-ed piece calling his Israel trip a big gaslighting charade. Is that entirely fair?
Well, I haven't caught up to date with all the stuff that's coming out on the websites right now. But what did he do? He went and he touched the wall. He told Netanyahu that, rather good, that both sides have to be happy with it. In fact, now that I think about it, I think it was a slightly unfair piece because Trump didn't just follow the lines that the Israeli government had expected him to. But he's such a rogue. I mean, he's such an uncontrolled missile that he went off in a direction they didn't want, in fact. So I think this is unpredictability, you see.
It is exactly that. And it is, I suspect, has been and is going to be the defining feature of his administration, however long it may last, that it's simply impossible to know what he actually thinks about anything from one minute to the next. I mean, Michael, did you get any sense at all of where Trump does sit? If on that spectrum between the Republican Party's institutional fetishization of Israel and the slightly unsavory anti-Semitic cranks that constitute portions of Trump's support and indeed entourage?
You know, the trip had changed enormously. Just in leading up to the moment he got on the plane in Riyadh to fly to Israel, he canceled the trip to Masada, which would have been a big thing, because they wouldn't let him land his helicopter on it. And it's a perfectly serviceable cable car, and it's quite a lovely view if you've ever done it.
I'm sympathetic to President Trump's views on cable cars.
Well, then, see?
However, when I went to Masada, I took the stairs.
I walked. You have to walk. What's the point? I mean, I took the cable car down. but it was... Anyway, look, I think all of this... We, in the press and those of us who sit back and analyze, we take this in a literal way, and we really shouldn't. I think his attention span is next to nil. And I think that these events happen, and we give them much more weight. No one who knows anything about the Middle East, and Donald Trump doesn't, by the way. Do you remember there was that wonderful moment in Israel where he was doing some press conference, said, yeah, I just came back from the Middle East. And Ron Dermer, who is the Israeli ambassador in Washington, just you literally see him facepalm in the clip. It was all over Twitter and Facebook yesterday. No, Saudi Arabia is the Middle East, and we're the Middle East too. You got it? He doesn't get it.
I mean, that may just be the political equivalent of the rock band who've been on tour too long and go out on stage in Baltimore.
He's only
and say
been
hello
on the road
New York
for like 3 days.
Yeah, but
he's
pretty old,
and he doesn't drink. So I'm sorry. No, I think that it's the wrong way to look at it. He can say, "Oh, I'm going to make peace." He has no idea what it is, what it's about. He can barely understand. The main thing that I was interested in is that this one really good photo that they set up for him at the Western Wall, and I don't know how he kept the yarmulke on. I'm Jewish. Whenever I've been to Jerusalem, I always go to the wall. I usually buy one on the spot. You know,
I borrowed one of the cardboard
and
ones.
And I put one on my head. You know, I've got a good head of hair, unlike him. I mean, his is all boofed up, but I have a thick head of hair. And the hardest thing in the world is to incline your forehead to the Western Wall, say the prayer, Shema Yisrael, and keep the damn kippah on your head. He had no problem. I want to know his secret.
Hairpins, I should have thought.
Didn't show up in the picture.
I mean, can I just put in the thing about, he's not Kissinger, meaning that he doesn't have the stamina of Kissinger. He is 72 or 73. Now, I don't mind that too much as we all surge our way towards this particular whatever, but he gets tired. I suspect Masada is as much as not wanting to, he's canceled something else as well. And one difficult thing is if you're going to be president, you have to be able to stay awake for quite a time. And so I suspect that some of it isn't ignorance, it's just being tired.
Hmm. We did see on the subject of curious photo opportunities, there's very strange pictures of the first family meeting with Pope Francis looking something like I don't know what it looked like, a sort of goth ABBA. Right. Michael, how do we imagine his meeting with Pope Francis went?
Well, I imagine it went...
Imagining Donald Trump meeting with anybody is kind of mind-boggling.
I think that the pictures that we've seen today, you know, the Pope is looking as Eeyore-ish as any supreme vicar of Christ on earth can look. With the President of the United States, I mean, even in his dotage, in his physically afflicted dotage, John Paul at least had a twinkle in his eye when he was in the company of an American president. I think that it's two stories. I think Donald Trump got his photo op. He's smiling bigly. And I think that the Pope probably... I have this feeling that on secure lines from Riyadh to Jerusalem to the Vatican and in a few days to Brussels... all of these leaders will be having very serious discussions about their assessments of what it's like to be in the room with him and what can be done.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Kathleen Burke and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, by way of reminder that the world isn't exclusively terrible, it's going from bad to worse at Fox News.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Join us as we discover the developers who are rethinking the property world, how you can build stores that work in a click-and-shop world, what the most inspirational entrepreneurs are planning, how you make a hit restaurant or fragrance firm, the media brands to watch, how we can green our cities, the future of transport, and much more besides. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister, with me, Kathleen Burke, and Michael Goldfarb. Now, if there ever was an imaginable logical endpoint to the belligerent, bloviating, and divisive rabble-rousing of Fox News, it was surely the elevation to the presidency of a boorish, incurious reality TV star. In Fox's moment of apparent triumph, however, things have gone wrong to a degree which, while not quite score-settling, offers some cosmic consolation. Along with the death of founder Roger Ailes, Fox has been beset by the disgrace and departure of its biggest star, Bill O'Reilly, its remaining biggest name, Sean Hannity, getting so weird even Fox viewers are starting to notice, and declining ratings. Last week it was beaten into third place in the profitable 25 to 54 age group by CNN and MSNBC. Kathleen, is it just the case with that Fox is kind of undergoing the same sort of existential meltdown that UKIP is here post-Brexit? Its work is done, isn't it?
Well, it's got its man as president, you mean. Surely, is there not... What do I know? I live in Oxford. I don't see Fox. But is there anything on Fox other than right-wing news and talk shows? Are there? Do they have situation comedies and so forth? I mean, that sort
not
of thing.
Not unless you think of its actual news programming as something of that ilk.
Well, then, if you're not going to turn to it to hear what's latest about the chap you worship, or whatever, why are you going to? What's really striking is NBC. Remember, it was nearly killed off not so many years ago. The thing is, you don't have to watch anything in particular. So if they're not watching Sean Hannity, more and more he's not being watched, is because more and more fewer and fewer people like what he has to say. Now, what does that mean for Fox? It means either they'd better ramp up Sean, as it were, or they need to try someone else fast.
Michael, how surprised are we by recent revelations which have seemed to suggest that quite a lot of Fox's most emblematic names are completely terrible people?
Come on, let's say this.
No slander.
Yeah. Come on. No one is surprised. And part of the reason for the ratings decline, doubtless, is the fact that Bill O'Reilly has been let gone. It's not that suddenly the demographic that is the core of watching Fox, which is white men in their mid-70s, you know, who have money in the bank, and white men in their mid-30s who have no money in the bank and are nodding out on opioids. Look, its raison d'etre hasn't been lost because Trump has been elected. It still has, I mean, it's about selling anger. It's about spinning news and calling it the facts, but in an angry and propagandistic way. But if you take away its biggest name, Bill O'Reilly, and Sean Hannity really tripped over himself in the last fortnight. Just give me a second to explain this. Last summer, a young man was murdered in Washington who happened to work for the Democratic National Committee. His name was Seth Rich. The D.C. police said it was a robbery gone wrong, and he was tragically killed. About 3 weeks ago, at the height of the Russia furore surrounding the Trump administration, from the alt-right insanity chamber, suddenly Seth Rich, this young man's name, becomes the big story at Fox.
It becomes the new Pizzagate.
Because he actually had given the Democratic National Committee emails to WikiLeaks, and the Clintons had ordered the hit on him, and so they murdered him. Now, it's just such a foul thing. Anyway, the young man's family took to the pages of the Washington Post, said, "Would you please let our son rest in peace, and let us rest in peace?" And this boiled for about 2 weeks, did its necessary job, which was it got some focus away from the news reporting on the investigations into the Trump campaign's connections to Russia. But it also really turned people off. And I think, and yesterday Hannity said, "I'm not going to report this anymore, but it may all be too late." The big thing about Fox and its Fox News is that it always has to be remembered. Even last year, it made $1.5 billion for Murdoch's News Corporation. And that kind of entry on anyone's balance sheet buys it a lot of time. But with Roger Ailes dead, and with Bill O'Reilly gone, it's likely that that kind of money will not be forthcoming. And as Rupert Murdoch himself begins to look at other ways to make himself felt in the company, and it comes under the purview of his sons, James and Lachlan, it wouldn't surprise me to see Fox gently change its format away from, you know, being a propaganda wing of the Tea Party.
But just a final thought from you on this one, Kathleen. Is it possible to imagine, following that up, that either Rupert or his sons, in the Fleet Street vernacular, turning their guns around? It wouldn't be the first time Murdoch has done that.
What do you mean by turning guns around?
As in just to decide to fire in another direction.
Well, they are going to have to do a bit of that, aren't they? Because they're trying to be able to buy Sky over here.
Yeah. I think that there's an element
they have to,
of
they,
that.
They have to calm down. And if getting rid of a man for whom they'd had to pay $13 million a year, I mean $13 million in total for all his sexual
harassment.
Approaches, I was going to say, unwelcome approaches. This man also is a financial difficulty as well as a moral difficulty. I mean, they thought it was a moral difficulty for quite some time, or they wouldn't be shelling out this money.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we shall move along to Taiwan, the highest court of which has ruled that current laws on marriage, which define it as an arrangement between a man and a woman, violate the country's constitution. This means that Taiwan's parliament has 2 years to write new laws, which may see Taiwan become the first Asian nation to permit same-sex marriage. As of right now, just 23 countries and/or jurisdictions have gotten with the program on this elementary qualification to civilization. Michael, is it a surprise that Taiwan might be the nation that leads the way in Asia?
Well, I don't know. Taiwan is this independent place, and I associate this kind of very progressive institutional step forward as one that takes place in countries that are secure, that have pretty decent economies, and it's something that people can focus on. So clearly, Taiwan is a secure country for the moment.
It's secure in a very curious and insecure and anomalous fashion.
But you know, look,
I haven't been to Taiwan, but I have been to
the People's Republic, and there, you know, in Beijing, there's a Taiwanese presence, and as an ignorant American, you assume that there will be no Taiwan people. But there's trading relations, and there's an understanding that if you're an island off the coast of the mainland with this many people, and you have this enormous power, it's also Chinese, you have to be very clever in how you conduct yourself. I don't know. I mean, it seemed like, I don't know.
Kathleen, can we be assured looking globally or confident looking globally that the traffic on this is one way? I mean, it is just 23 countries and or jurisdictions so far, but this has all mostly happened really recently. It has happened quite quickly.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm just as surprised as Michael is, I suspect, that it is Taiwan. But that tells me two things. First of all, China is not going to conquer Taiwan to strike down its gay marriage law. So in that sense, it's not a danger in that. On the other hand, it's also rather nice that the judiciary system is so established in Taiwan that they were able to change the approach to gay marriage. You're quite right. Only 23 countries against virtually all of Africa and Asia. So Taiwan stands out. But maybe Taiwan rather likes to stand out. It shows that it's a beacon of civil society and judicial values that those around them ought to look at.
And on that optimistic note, we do have to leave it. Although, as an Australian, I am going to remind my nation, if it happens to be listening, that Australia is still not among that list of 23 countries, which is frankly ridiculous, and it's getting kind of embarrassing. Kathleen Burke and Michael Goldfarb, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Bill Luthi and Hemina Minan Vega, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. More music next at 1900. Daniel's in with the entrepreneurs, and I'll have more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.